continue our discussion, trying to develop a better understanding of God. And there are a lot of aspects of God that we touch on periodically, but we rarely, I rarely think about how God is unchanging. And it is an important idea. God's unchangeableness extends to, well, our author has suggested that it extends to four areas, and it extends beyond that. I would have broken them out a little bit differently, but God just never changes. And in the world that we're familiar with, everything changes. Change is kind of a fact of life. And we don't like it very much, but it's something that happens. Kim always says nobody likes change except the wet baby. And, you know, there's some validity to that. We don't like change, but we live in a world that is so characterized by change that we just can't escape it. So I want to think about the unchangeableness of God in terms that I think bring it home to us. So we'll talk a little bit about his unchanging life. Then we'll talk a little bit about his unchanging character. We'll talk a little bit about God's truth as unchanging. And then we'll talk finally about God's purpose as unchanging. So all of those things are important to us. They're really the basis for our relationship with God. So let's talk about God's life as unchanging. If there's anything that I know about life, is we get old. And as we age, things don't work the way that they did when we were younger. I mean, I'm 72. 70. But yeah, I'm 72. Yeah. Hey, think for a minute. I'm 72, and I can't see very well. And my hearing's shot, and can't walk very far. I had to have my heart's wearing out, so I had to have a pacemaker put in. It just seems like life as we know it is a series of changes. And that's not characteristic of God. It's hard for me to imagine a God who is fully formed in creation and who stays fully formed, who just stays the same as he's always been. So let's look at some statements about God. And what I'd like to do is, as we go through this, read these passages and then have you give me your impressions about what that passage says to you. So let's start in Psalms 93 and verse 2. Can you get someone to read that? And then comment on how you think that translates into your life.
Thy throne is established from old. Thou art from everlasting. Okay. God has been there forever.
Okay. Well, so what does it mean? You are from everlasting.
From the beginning. There is no end. There is no
end. Okay. Any other thoughts? That's not a phrase that I ever use. Yeah, Kim.
Well, I think about David writing this, and he's the king. And Israel, hasn't always been in existence. And so I think David is contrasting here sort of the newness of his reign and the newness of his nation, and saying, God, you've been here all along. And so for me, when I think about that, I think about this coming from King David. It's establishing sort of our finite experience and his infinite experience, and making a contrast and comparison. So from everlasting, we have a hard time in our, it's a weird word, but I don't know of another word to use, our humanness, our humanity, understanding what eternity really is and what everlasting really means. It has no beginning and no ending. And that applies to God and his reign. And he was on his throne. His throne was established without a beginning and without an end. And David's saying, I have a beginning and an end, and you don't, God. I think that just puts it in perspective.
Yeah, Carol?
It made me, when you were talking, made me think about Adam being fully grown when he was formed. It's sort of like God is saying, you know, there's no need for any change. What you have is what you need, and you don't have to grow any. It's not just that, well, there was nobody to take care of a baby. It's that God made Adam ready for this world. Just like God is always ready for whatever is out there.
No, it's interesting. And it does kind of reflect in the way that he made Adam. That's an interesting notion. Other thoughts about God being from everlasting?
I think there's a big... Before the beginning, and he created the beginning, actually, and it never ends. It's always everlasting. It never ends.
Okay. Does anybody else see the headline in the paper just recently that the petrodollar is dead? That oil funds will no longer be denominated in American dollars? And, you know, there's a sense in which you think that's never going to change. A barrel of oil is so many dollars. And our nation is not from everlasting. Our nation is as nations go, we're a young group. And we're not going to last forever. And it's hard to see that if you're thinking about our national identity. And so I put that into the context of God and his authority, his reign just never changes. You know, at one time, Rome was the power that ruled the world. Pax Romana, we will have peace because everybody does it our way. That's not a view of peace. And then you had countries that came along after that. And I can't imagine, if you lived during the ascendancy and the power of Nazi Germany, you probably thought this is never going to end. But it did. And it only lasted for a very short time when you think about it. The Chinese Empire, the Chinese kings, you think they rule the world, but they don't. The Egyptians, the Chinese, the American experience, the British experience. You know, it was said that the sun never sets on the British Empire. And it looked for a while like they were the big power, and they were always going to be the big power. And they're gone. You know, England is still here. Britain is still here, and I have trouble remembering whether it's Great Britain or England or what I ought to be referencing, but they're still here. They're just not what they were. France, Germany, the Austrian Empire, the Russian Empire, everything changes. Not God. How about Jeremiah 10 at verse 10?
But the Lord is the true God. He is the living God and the everlasting King. At his wrath, the earth quakes, and his nations cannot endure his indignation.
Okay. What do you see Jeremiah as trying to tell the people of Israel?
You don't want to make God angry.
Okay. A good one.
He still rules over everybody.
Okay.
Again, context. He's talking about idols here, and he's contrasting God with idols. And he's saying the idols don't even hold up to this. When God's wrath is proclaimed against a nation, the whole nation trembles. When if you take off an idol, well, nothing's going to happen. So I think what he's saying here, because he's talking about the craftsmen and the goldsmiths and what they have made, and that people are worshiping that, and he's saying, but the Lord is the true God. He's the living God, the eternal King. And like you said, God's life is unchanging. And I have never really considered, I guess, God as having life, because I think of life as sort of human, as being earthly. I'll say it that way. But that's not true. We know that Jesus is living. And right here he says he is the living God. He has a life. And these idols are just lifeless. And so I think he's contrasting again, which is the way we human beings think. We have to have a compare and contrast to really get a good picture. And I think that's what he's doing here. And he's saying, watch out, because when he's angry, everybody trembles. Idols don't get angry. You may think they do, but if they do, nothing's going to happen. So I it says the nations cannot endure his wrath. It's a pretty fearful thing to fall under the wrath of a living God.
Okay.
So as opposed to a dead idol, he's alive.
Yeah, sure.
Well, nations cannot endure his indignation. It's like when God steps on you, you're going to know it. Nobody's going to be guessing, well, now did we please the Lord, please this God or please that God or whatever. When God says you're wrong, you're going to know it.
Okay. Well, let's look at Romans 1:23. Anybody want to read that? Somebody want to read that from that's on Zoom?
I'll read it. And exchange the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and of birds and of four-footed animals and of crawling creatures.
Okay. So what do you see there?
That just in order to have something in your hand to say that you can worship, it's nothing, because God is not corruptible. God is true. And these other gods that you make are not.
Okay. So correct me if I'm wrong, but your idea of incorruptible is that he is not corrupted by sin.
That's right. He never makes the misstep. He's
okay.
He's pure that way. Yeah.
Okay. I have to admit, I look at that at the word incorruptible a little bit differently. Things are corrupted. If you have a pure glass of water, nothing in it except water, and you just set it down for a minute, there will be stuff in it. Okay? It's like leaven in dough. If you mix dough, immediately there's leaven in it. And the way the Jews dealt with that is when they mixed their unleavened bread, they cooked it within just a very few minutes. And that would stop the leaven from growing in that bread. But it's almost impossible to have a loaf of dough and it not have some sort of leaven in it. And, you know, you probably know that better than I do, John. So, if you live in San Francisco and you make sourdough, it tastes like San Francisco sourdough, right? It's got San Francisco in it, okay? For want of a better way to describe it. Kim makes sourdough, and it tastes like my house, because that's the yeast that got in it. It corrupted it. It changed it. And things that are corrupted are just passing away. Think about an idol. If a stonemason makes an idol out of pure granite, the minute you pick it up, there's some of your DNA that's deposited on that granite. It's not pure granite anymore. And that doesn't apply to God. God cannot be touched with corruption. That's a fascinating statement, at least to me. We talk about people who come into government with the purest of motives, and after they're in government in just a little while, they're corrupted, and their motives are no longer as pure as they were when they came into government. That doesn't apply to God. He is incorruptible. Okay, let's look at 1 Timothy 6, verse 16.
This is talking about the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, who alone is immortal and who lives in unapproachable light, whom no one has seen or can see. To him be honor and might forever. Amen.
Okay. What's that say to you?
Are you asking me?
Yeah.
Oh, I think about immortal and immortality, I think about what you referenced early in this session, is that as mortals, as we grow older, we're changing all the time. And we're degrading, I guess, as a matter, as a way to say it. Our bodies change, and as we get older, we notice those changes even more. When we're young and growing, we notice those changes, and then in midlife, it seems like everything kind of slows down a little bit. But then as we get a little bit older, it seems to accelerate, and God doesn't experience that. And I don't know what to make of He lives in unapproachable light, other than no one has seen or can see. I mean, He did show himself one time, but that we know of. But no one could see him directly. I'm not sure what to make of that. I'm kind of thinking about that one. But that's something to be honored and forever. So
okay.
I don't know. Kind of.
Yeah, Carol.
Too much light, too bright a light, and we as humans, we can't see. Basically, that's what makes God. And we can't see God with our eyes. We can only see God with our heart. And even then, we do a very poor job of it. But what we do know of God is to him be honor and eternal dominion. So we can at least get that far. But with our eyes, we can't see. Even if we could see God, even if he was there, we have this limitation here on earth of really understanding who God is and how great he is and how smart he is. And I mean, just even for him to understand how many hairs I have on my head and what I'm going to do just my whole life. And then everybody I know and everybody who came before them and everybody comes after. I mean, that just boggles my mind. And if you look at the universe, I mean, when people used to look and saw the, you know, the planets and they thought, okay, that's basically the universe. And now look at how much greater the universe is that we can tell. And we still can't take it in. I mean, it's amazing the transformation between point A and point B about knowing that. And his revelation will be even greater.
And the universe is running down, right? That's all of the evidence that we have is the universe is running down. Things are slowing down. Things are degrading. They're devolving. The universal experience of mankind is not evolution from disorganized to better organized. The entire history of mankind is we go from better organized to less organized. It's called atrophy. There's no way to escape it in our experience. So it's very difficult for us to imagine immortality. You know, I think about Adam and Eve in the garden. Adam and Eve were not built to die. They were made, and they could have lived forever. But just the way that they would live forever is different than the way that God lives forever, because their key to immortality was the tree of life. And remember, after they sinned, they had that conversation, and within the Godhead, they said, now we have to keep them away from the tree of life so that they won't live forever. But that's not immortality. That's constant renewal. If there's a way to express that difference, Adam and Eve weren't like God in that God never needs to be renewed. He didn't need access to the tree of life to renew his life and extend it like Adam and Eve did. And that's the closest that we can ever get to immortality. Yeah, Jimmy.
I was just thinking, God is a spirit. He's not mortal. And he's nothing like us because he's perfect. He never sins. And he stays the same always. But mortals change. They use their minds and misuse things and everything else because they are tempted to sin and do whatever is what they think they ought to do or not to do.
Good point. So as I was reflecting on what that means to us, what that means to me, I need something that I can absolutely rely on. No matter what else I rely on, you know, you think, well, I'm always going to be strong enough to be able to do whatever I want to do. And the time is coming when I'm not. And maybe it's already here, but there was a time when if somebody needed to climb a ladder and do something, I just went up the ladder and did it. And I can't do that anymore.
Now you call Evan.
Now I call Evan, or I call Ted, or Seth, or Nolan, or Andrew. And those guys can climb the ladder. But even for them, their life will run down. Yeah, Carol.
If this is supposing, but if Adam and Eve had been able to eat of the fruit and have eternal life, wouldn't their existence have ended when time and the universe ended?
I don't know the answer to that. All I know, it's a good observation. All I'm going by is what that conversation with the Godhead, within the Godhead, was. Now we have to keep them from access to the tree of life. So, you know, I'm not sure what I make of that exactly, but it's a good point. Yeah, Kim?
Yeah, I'm looking at your questions. What's the practical meaning and what does this fact do for us? And, you know, I think about, and probably people in every generation could say this, but I look at my lifetime. And when I was a kid, I remember families who worshiped together, whether they worshiped at the church or not, they were held in respect. They had values. They had, you know, families were intact. There were some, you know, split families, but by and large, they were intact. They, in our culture, that was honored and respected. And then in the 1960s, this whole humanism thing started to creep into our culture. Not just creep in, I think it was intentional. And it has grown to the point now, and I think, again, this has been orchestrated, that we worship human beings. We don't honor and worship God anymore as a culture. In fact, in God we trust, people want to get rid of those sayings. They want to get rid of our flag and what it stands for. They want to get rid of the fact that we pride ourselves as a nation that's built on godly principles, that we're a Christian Judeo-Christian culture and society. And now we've gotten to the fact that people ridicule that. It's grown in the last 50 years, the changes in our human experience, in our culture, in America, it has changed so much, where the focus is so far, not just away from God, but it shuns God. And it recognizes and honors and respects and worships humans and our choice and our own personal truth, whatever that is. I get to decide my own personal truth. There is no such thing as truth anymore. Well, that has happened in our culture in the last 50 years. And we're seeing the results of it now. And if we look here and we look at what God is, that's what the fact does for me, is it takes the cultural stuff and it debunks it, and it just says, shun that, get rid of it, don't let that permeate my thinking. I need to honor and respect God for who he is. Anyway, that's just...
Yeah, and that's a good segue into the next point.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Before we leave this point, though, I want to think about something that I read sometimes I read things 2 years ago and it seems like I read it yesterday. So my memory is kind of jumbled up. That's one of those things that's going. So somebody said, we want the church the way it was in the 1930s to be the way it is today, mistaking what was in the 1930s for something that's unchangeable. And this person was talking about sometimes we have the idea that our church is a memorial church. We want it to be like the 1930s. If it was just like the 1930s, then we wouldn't have these problems. And I don't think we can replace God with a changing church. So we'll just kind of, I'll throw that out there as something to think about, something to kind of ponder and see if we can make some sense out of that. I change, okay? And as I change, I have to have a relationship with an unchanging God. That doesn't mean that I can't change. I change. And I think that same thing is true of churches. So we'll just put that out there, and it's something to think about. So let's think about the character of God as unchanging. With God, there's no variation. And Kim pointed out really what I was going to point out, that God shows no sense in which he is variable. Yeah, there's some things that I thought I could always count on, that you don't steal from other people. And I thought, at some level, that always has to be true. And it's always going to be a part of our law structure that you don't steal from other people. And I go back to the Code of Hammurabi, the first written down codified form of law. And theft was prohibited in the Code of Hammurabi. And I thought, okay, theft is not going to change. Laws are always going to be the same as it concerns theft, and it's not anymore. Now, even in our country, you can squat in somebody's house, and eventually you can take it from them. And it amazes me that that kind of thing happens in our country in the last 10 years, probably, so that people can just take your stuff with immunity and with the backing of the government. You say, you're squatting in my house. You have to leave. And the court say, no, you can't do that. And I'm flabbergasted by the pace of change. So James chapter 1 verse 17. With God there is no shadow of turning. There is no variableness, to use the King James language. No shadow of turning. And I think that's talking about the passage of time and how the sun, the earth rotates around the sun, and there is always day and night. And depending upon where we are in that rotation, then there's day and night. There are seasons, and they don't change. And the fact is that they do. True north moves. If you take a compass and calibrate it to give you true north today, in 100 years, it won't point to true north. So, I mean, how is it possible that there's anything that doesn't change. And that's God. He never changes at all. Can somebody read James 3, or James 1, verses 13 through 18, to sort of set the stage for what James says in verse 17? Verses 13 through 18.
When tempted, no one should say, God is tempting me. For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when, by his own evil desire, he is dragged away and enticed. Then, after desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. Don't be deceived, my dear brothers. Every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of the heavenly lights, who does not change like shifting shadows. He chose to give us birth through the word of the truth, the word of truth, that we might be a kind of first fruits of all he created.
Okay. So how do you see that as related to God not changing? His character not changing?
In verse 17, it says there's no variation with God. He's always the same, and he does not change, but we do.
Okay.
Verse 18 says he brought us forth by the word of truth so that we might be as if were the first fruits among his creatures. So it's his truth that keeps us from changing. And you were talking sort of about the church changing. And the problem with that, of course, is the contrast that God is unchanging. So how can the church be changing? And, well, because the church is filled with fallible people, but because we look at his word in the wrong way. And it says that the word of the Lord hangs on love. Every law is hung on law. As he hangs the universe, it's an invisible thing. And we don't necessarily see the love behind the law. We might be dictatorial about something, or, you know, too strict about something, where God had the love there and we didn't perceive it. So God's church looks like it's changing, but God's word never does. It's always the truth.
Okay.
Well, we human beings kind of have a tendency to have difficulty with personal accountability. And I think what he's saying here is, you know, by this deception. So if I'm tempted, or if I'm up against a wall or something, God has created this. God made this happen. And I don't have to take responsibility for myself and my conduct and my behavior. And he says, no. If you fall into temptation, it's because this process happened to you and you were involved in it. You, by your own evil desire. And then you were dragged away, and this happened, and it has nothing to do with God. In fact, then he says, don't be deceived. Don't be deceived, because we deceive ourselves all the time. If we're caught in sin, it's somebody else's fault. It's not ours. It's, you know, this, the, or the circumstances. It's the circumstances' fault, which is another way of saying it's God's fault. And then he says, no, God's not like that. God is going to give you every good and perfect gift. He doesn't change like the shadows are. Shadows are constantly changing. So to me, that's kind of what that means. Is again, he's comparing and contrasting. He's basically saying, you human beings, you need to stand up and take ownership for your part in this. And it's not God's fault. God only gives you the good stuff. He doesn't give you the bad stuff. The bad stuff is from you. And you letting Satan, it doesn't talk about Satan in this context right here, but this comes from you. It doesn't come from God. So don't say it comes from God.
Okay. Yeah, Hill.
Well, it takes me back, as it does a lot of times, to where Cain offered the wrong sacrifice. And God told Cain, if you just do what's right, won't your countenance rise? And he says, the wolf is at the door. In other words, you're right there at that pivotal point where, as Ken says, you can blame your brother. You can blame that. You need to make that decision right now, because do what's right.
Okay. Good point. So, I think we contrasted it with our changeableness, right? Everything I can think of changes. And, you know, there's this thought, okay, the Supreme Court decided in our country, this is the way that the law ought to be. This is what the law says. And you go 50 years down the road and somebody decides, no, that's not what it says. So even our laws, the Constitution, the very basic documents, it seems like they're changing all the time. And they don't change. You know, I worked in a radio pharmacy for a while. And one of the things that was impressed upon me is the laws of physics and the laws of chemistry don't change. But they do. It's just that they don't change from yesterday to today. If you look at it over thousands and thousands and thousands of years, everything changes. Except God. Except God. You think about radioisotopes, and they seem like they're emitting this dangerous a particle that's going to do damage to your body. Well, if you just let that radioisotope sit for long enough, it'll become inert. It may have a half-life of a billion years, but it will run down. And we dealt with stuff that had a half-life of 8 hours, 8 days, sometimes 100 days. But at the end of 100 days, half of the energy that was in that vial is gone. Okay. So things just change all the time. Only God stays the same. We're out of time.